Well, this is Lo-Fi Lit. This is a podcast series where I, Tyler Byrne, host interviews with writers, artists, and the great array of people that I meet on and across the internet. I met Jamie Hood in 2020, right before the pandemic hit. I was a fan of her Twitter. I saw that she had an Amazon wish list, and she was a very hard worker. There were a few books on her wish list, and I purchased one of the books for her. And she was very nice. And she asked me, you know, how I was doing during like COVID and all that. And we just struck up a conversation over DMs for about, you know, I would say a month or two or three. We're just talking back and forth. I was very, like, surprisingly, like, vulnerable and open to just, like, I just felt like I was treated with respect and kindness that, I felt like an adult. I don't know. I felt like, because I exist in these very niche communities, and I feel like those communities, you kind of move about in similar ways, and you become known as a certain type of person interacting in these small communities. You kind of get branded a certain type of way, or you act a certain way. And then, like with Jamie, I was acting a different way, but still myself. It was awesome, and it is a time and place in a sort of a conversation between me and Jamie that, like, just that time period I reflect back on very positively and very warmly, and I will always remember and have a fond memories of during one of the worst periods in probably the world. So many people died, and so much horrible shit was happening, and here I was coming home, working on a night crew, one of the worst jobs you could possibly have during COVID-19. And I'd come home and DM Jamie Hood, who is at Very Hot Mom on Twitter, a very popular account. And this was a time when this was like before Jamie's essay came out. And then it came out and Jamie kind of blew up. And Jamie traversed the, you know, indie communities that we participate in. And then, you know, we'd interact here and there. And then I felt like, you know, got to go do my own thing. Jamie went and did her own thing. We stopped communicating as much because I don't want to be like a parasite. And every now and then we'll communicate. Anyways, this book, I'm so excited for Jamie. It was so cool that she came on. I wasn't expecting her to come on. I feel like she's kind of like on the totem pole of success, like above me, but she was kind enough to come on and was game to come on. And yeah, amazing. Because when I was like interacting with her back in 2020, had no conception or plans to start a podcast. I'd always wanted to, never had the guts to do it. And then I started one. And over time, this has just accumulated. And I got to like read her book before it came out. And that's like one of the coolest fucking things I've ever gotten to do. like, this is fucking cool. This is the greatest episode. Like, this was just not the great. I don't know what I'm talking about now. I'm just like kind of rambling. Jamie's awesome. Jamie's fucking awesome. And she came on my show and I got to read her book before like other people did. Like, and I hope you guys enjoy this episode. This was awesome. I love this. This was great. This was fantastic. This was phenomenal. This was amazing. This was astronomically one of the coolest things I get to do because I do this podcast. You guys should do a podcast and buy people books. I don't know. How do you know what book they want? Well, have to study them, I guess. Okay, I'll see you guys later. This is Lo-Fi Lit with Tyler. Go buy Trauma Plot. Jamie Hood out now by Pantheon Books, I believe. Let's go.
I'm very tired. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. But like, isn't this like the most exciting thing like of your life too?
Yeah, it is pretty exciting. Is it the most exciting moment of my life? It is definitely very exciting. I don't know. I think with anything like this, there's always a little uncertainty, you know. I don't know how it's going to be received. I don't know what my career looks like after this moment, but yeah, it does feel really cool to, I guess, be in a place where a lot of people are interested in the work that I spent so long doing. So,
are you scared that it won't be received well? I mean, there's already a promotion where you can like, you get like a signed copy of the book. I mean, that has to be kind of telling. That's probably going to do pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I guess the worry is more just sort of like, less about the sort of financial success of the book and more about how it's going to be assimilated into conversations about rape culture and memoirs and the way that people write about trauma.
Are you afraid maybe of how it might be criticized as a feminist work?
I think that I feel very lucky because I like the team I have at my publisher, but I also have like great girlfriends who are going to sort of insulate me if I need to be insulated. You know, like one of the first reviews came out this week very early, and my publicist sent it to me with the, like, you know, with the email line being like the great review. And so I was like, oh, sure, I'll read it, you know? And it was a brilliant review. It was very, you know, not only like complimentary, which is of course your ego wants that, but it was also just like very smart and very well written. And I was very impressed. And I think because also like I work as a critic, in addition to being a memoirist, like, yeah, my eye is also on like the way that the critical apparatus works, even when the subject of criticism is myself. But am I scared of being criticized? Yeah, of course. I mean, like, I don't know, we're supposed to pretend like that's not a fear that we have going into this process, but of course it doesn't feel good, you know? Like, it doesn't feel good for someone to tell you your work is shitty or like you're stupid or something.
I mean, like, I feel like you're changing the game, like, with this book and how you're approaching storytelling, how you're approaching memoir. Like, I feel like this is a book, it's going to be like, people are going to like in like periodical journals, you know, and like literature, like in like classes and stuff, people are going to be writing about it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, I really hope so.
Cause that's what you grew up on, that kind of stuff. Like, that's what you studied in school.
I did a doctoral program. Yes. In literature. And I did two masters. I did one in English and one in women's studies. Yeah. My training was academic. But that, you know, that feels like such a lifetime ago. Like, literally, I've been in New York for 12 years. I fled my PhD to come to New York. So I feel like It's sort of funny that a couple of the people who are written about in the book and my, about like the time of period where I was in grad school have recently reached out to like reconnect, which is kind of cool. But I'm also like, oh shit, like, I guess you're going to see yourself in the book. So, but yeah, I don't know. The academic training is just so far from me. Like, it's just not how I, it's not the way that I like look at the world anymore, but yeah, I don't know. We don't cut all of our histories off of ourselves, right?
Could you talk a little bit about like growing, like where you grew up in your childhood, just to get a foundation for who you are?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Virginia, in Southeast Virginia, Virginia Beach. I'm trying to think. I guess I've never actually done this. What was my childhood like? It was fine. I don't know. I mean, there are parts of it that were very traumatizing, which I outline in the book. But, you know, ultimately, I have a really wonderful relationship with my mom and with my little sister. And the three of us were always very close. And my mom was a single mom. I grew up watching her bartend. I used to sit at the counter of the VFW while she was bartending sometimes.
Well, your mom was a bartender?
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
She, by the time I was like 10, I want to say, she had shifted gears and she was working as a special ed teacher. But when I was little and she couldn't afford a sitter for both me and my sister, like she only had enough money to pay for the sitter to watch my sister, who was 6 years younger than me, she would bring me to work. And so like I'd go to Applebee's, I'd go to the VFW, I'd go to, there was another one. Maybe it was TGI Fridays. I don't know. There were a lot of franchise restaurants in my background, both because of my mom and because of my first jobs. But that was the sort of entree I had into bartending, was like watching my mom do it. I thought, obviously, I hate working it as a job myself now, and I've done it for a long time. But watching her do it always felt very glamorous. Like I felt very adult, like sitting at the counter, drinking virgin mudslides, and like reading my little books and stuff. So that was sort of, you know, a lot of my childhood I don't remember, but one of those memories that feels very salient and very present is just sort of like that experience of watching my mom and thinking how glamorous she seemed while she was working. I don't know. And then like I was in Virginia until I went to college, and I went to a college in Virginia. It just wasn't my hometown. I went to William & Mary, and I did a lot of theater in high school. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I was a very shy kid. And I got to ninth grade, and I was like, a teacher called on me in English class, like my subject, you know, the thing that I loved. And a teacher called on me, and I was so scared. I literally couldn't speak. Like I was so scared to talk in the classroom that I could not speak. And I was like, this is not a way to live a life. And so I decided to break my shyness. And the two things I did was I got a job at Chili's as a waitress, and I auditioned for a musical in my high school theater program, and I got a part. And yeah, when I went to college, I thought I was going to be an actress.
Wow.
And I got to college, and I remember on like the first week I was there, I saw Glenn Close. She was like wandering around the campus because her daughter, she had gone to William & Mary, and she was, you know, there are pictures of Glenn Close all over the theater department of William & Mary. And she was there with her daughter, I think, who was maybe gonna apply or go there or something. And I got to the theater program there, and I just realized I didn't have the chops. Like I wasn't cut out for it. For any number of reasons. Like, I guess there are parts of acting that I miss a lot, but, you know, sometimes it's important to realize that a dream of yours is not going to become a reality. And I shifted into writing, which I had always done. And I did a lot of creative writing classes in college. When I went to grad school, what I really wanted was to get into an MFA PhD, but I don't know what the ecosystem is like now. I can only imagine it's worse, but at the time I think there were five programs in the entire country that did a joint MFA PhD, and they were incredibly difficult to get into. I think maybe like 20 or 30 people a year got into any of, you know, among all of them. And so that did not happen, but I did get into some PhD programs, and I went to Boston and did my doctoral program there. I didn't finish my dissertation, but
I think it's fine.
People are always just like, oh, do I have to call you doctor? I'm like, only if you want to, because I didn't technically get the degree. I was like in the middle of my dissertation when I left. So
why was the PhD part important to you?
Basically because I thought that I was going to become an academic, and I thought that, you know, I think because I had grown up so poor, like we grew up, it's not like we were like fucking, you know, the worst off, you know, the people who were worst off or whatever, worse off, what is the word I'm looking for here? It was not like abject poverty, but we grew up very working class. And like I said, my mom, like when I was a kid, was working two jobs. She was in night school. I did think that her bartending was very glamorous, but I also didn't want to, you know, I knew she was so tired all the time, and I didn't want that. Like, and I also wanted to like find a way to achieve some level of financial stability to help my mother out. Sort of like, you know, I kind of saw like our little familial history as very like kind of in the muck of like working class experience. And so, you know, there was a lot of class aspirationalism and how I came up. I think that was another thing that kind of drew me to acting, where it was like, this is one way of like getting over my shyness, but also like if you become a successful actor, you know, like we were so embedded in celebrity culture when I was a teenager. Like I was like, oh, well, I'll just become a famous actress and then my mom will never have to worry again. Obviously it's not that easy, but so, you know, like the compromise I made was that I would become a professor and that I would just get a tenure track job. And then I would not have to worry about money and I would be able to help my mom out. And that was sort of the idea. But you know, it was sort of another one of those dreams that collapsed because I was in my PhD. For one thing, I was miserable. And I hated Boston. I think it's the worst city in the world, possibly. I haven't been to all of them, but it's definitely the worst one that I've lived in or like visited. And I guess the other thing was that like I was in grad school kind of like immediately in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. And the humanities were collapsing all around me. I mean, like, I can't imagine what it's like now. Like, do people go to English PhDs thinking they're going to get a job? Because I did. And at the time, it became very clear within like a couple of years that that was never going to fucking happen. And not even like on a merit, like, not even on the level of merit, just that like, there weren't jobs. Like, regardless of whether or not I was good enough to get one of those jobs, there weren't any. So... yeah, that was sort of, the idea was always just like, you know, I love reading and I thought I would love teaching. As it turns out, I did not. It seemed like some sort of pathway to stability, you know, like a stability I'd never experienced before then, a stability I frankly, like basically have never experienced since then. I think like right now I'm at the best place I've ever been in my life, just sort of in terms of having a sort of routine and like knowing where my money comes from. But that I guess, sorry, I'm rambling, but that.
Did your interest for like women's studies, was that coming from like watching your mom and having a single mom and seeing her work so hard?
Well, when she was in school, she went to, one of the big schools in the area where I grew up is Old Dominion University. And my mom took a bunch of feminist classes there. My mom's not a huge reader. I don't say that to insult her. She just didn't have time. And so I think one of the things that was so, you know, another one of those memories I have of my mother from my childhood that felt so beautiful to me was like when she would take these women's studies classes, she really got to read. She had to read, like she had to make time for reading. And she really wanted to share those texts with me. And she was very like thrilled by them and like moved. And I think that feminist theory and feminist fiction allowed my mother to dream of a better life than the one that she had had and the one that she currently, you know, at that time had as well. And so I think, you know, yeah, there was definitely like a sort of matrilineal history there where like I had seen my mother read Betty Friedan and Simone de Beauvoir and like feminist fairy tale revisions, which is how I ended up doing the thesis I did in undergrad. I don't know. I just like feminist theory feels very inextricable from my like way of understanding the world.
So your love from reading came from going to the bars, because like there probably wouldn't be a lot of other things to do other than read.
Well, I think that I was just a very, very internal child, and I really didn't know how to be with others. I didn't like being with others. I felt very isolated. And, you know, again, not to say that we had the worst experience as children, like plenty of kids have much worse childhoods than I did. But I think that what I did in looking to stories was try to imagine a different life for myself. And I needed to be able to have that hope and that like capacity to dream, because I felt very confined in my world and I didn't really see a way out, you know, because I saw how deeply my mother struggled.
And
like reading, it was escapist, but it was also, I think that like books enabled my capacity to retain optimism despite like deep suffering, you know? I don't know. I was a very, a bookish child. It was where I felt safe.
What were the books you were reading at that time? I'm sorry to be focusing so much attention on this, but it's just like really interesting.
Okay. What did I read? I mean, I read the classics, you know, I read like The Little Princess and The Secret Garden. I read all the Anne of Green Gables series. I loved those diaries, like the American Girl diaries. It's not American Girl dolls, but like, it's like historical diaries. I'm trying to think what else. I read, the Alice books, Wizard of Oz, that series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, things like that. I really did orient. I think I had like a real affinity for Victorian children's literature. And like sort of immediately post-Victorian children's literature. And then when I got a little older, like when I was in middle school, I started reading a lot of books that were like horror oriented. Like I read a fuck ton of Stephen King in middle school. I remember I got in trouble in seventh grade civics class because I was reading The Stand under my desk. And when I like got called to speak to the teacher afterwards, I was kind of like, well, I already did all the homework. I did all the classwork. I was done and everyone else was still working. I don't know, like I can sit there and stare at the wall or I can do something else. And to her credit, the teacher kind of was like, oh, okay, sure. And like, and that was like a permission that I had from then on. Like, as long as I had finished my work, I was allowed to read under the desk while I was in class. And then, high school, trying to think what like, I really loved Greek myths, which maybe I guess that sort of plays into the new book where I like write about Ovid, but I didn't read Ovid in high school. We read like that very classic Edith Hamilton mythology book. And I read the Odyssey. I read the Iliad. I read like Oedipus Rex. I was super into an Antigone. I read a lot of Plath in high school. I read the Brontes. I was obsessed with Wuthering Heights. I read Henry James's The Portrait of a Lady, and I didn't understand it at all. I think I just sort of like turned those pages, but it became, you know, later became like one of the books that I've gone back to like half dozen times. Like I reread that book whenever I have enough time to do it. And it's, yeah, so deeply informative. Also, just like I started reading a lot of like feminist literature. Like I loved Kate Chopin's The Awakening. I loved Toni Morrison, who I read a lot of in college, actually. But I did read, I think, The Bluest Eye and Sula in high school.
Are you excited that your name is now going to be associated with these women?
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I'm going to be... People are going to be like, yes, my two favorite writers are Toni Morrison and Jamie Hood, but I guess it's possible.
Yeah, we don't know what books you're still going to write, too.
That's true. I mean, mainly I have the one that's coming out right now, which I hope people love.
Oh, people are going to love this. You said you hated teaching. I feel like, did you hate it because of the job or the things going on in your life at that time?
Well, I hated the bureaucracy of it. I actually liked being in the classroom, and I try to remind myself of that, particularly because it's like not out of the realm of possibility that I'll end up in a classroom again, you know? God knows I don't want to bartend anymore. So like, if one way of doing that is like writing and also adjuncting as opposed to writing and bartending to make up my rent, then maybe that is on the horizon. I don't know. I think that I would do a lot of things differently. I think I was much more of a hard ass as a teacher than I probably should have been. It was difficult though. You know, I was 23 when I started teaching because I went straight from undergrad to grad school. I was still 22 that first year. And so like I had students who were older than me. Most of the students were, if they were younger, were only younger by a year or two. And it is hard to command authority in a classroom when students functionally want to treat you as a peer. And I think that was difficult. And so I had sort of an antagonistic relationship at times to my students because I felt like I had to establish control in some way. But the thing I really didn't, you know, like I didn't like all the red tape. Like, I didn't like that we weren't allowed to grade honestly, for example. I didn't like, you know, pedagogy meetings. I didn't like having, like, not even the office hours were whatever, but like, we had to have such insane conference schedules as in addition to office hours. Ultimately, that was, you know, kind of the only way you would ever see your students outside of the classroom. They wouldn't come to your office hours, but like, still, it just like, it felt like it took so much time just to orchestrate the scaffolding of teaching as opposed to like being able to spend real meaningful quality time, like being present as a teacher. So I guess that's it. I mean, of course, the things that were going on at the time, I assume you're referring to what I write about in the book, which is like, I had in the last like year and a half of my grad school experience, I was raped twice. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think that that stained something about that period for me. A lot of personal difficulties that I was struggling with in the years I was in my PhD program. And they certainly didn't help. I hope, you know, I like to think that I remained pretty professional. But I was under a lot of like, I was experiencing a lot of grief and a lot of dissociation and really struggling to figure out how to survive, I guess, you know, like I was also, yeah, it was just a very difficult time.
There's a choice that you make in the book that I love, kind of a shadow character called the Spectre. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, is the Spectre kind of the audience, the reader, and Jamie from the past is kind of recognizing the, I don't know, maybe that's too stupid, but
no, it's great. I feel like I can't answer it because I feel like I have my personal feelings about what, so I guess just for context, so the book is split into four parts. And each of the parts takes a sort of different form. But the first part is kind of a third person autofiction. And it takes place across the course of a single day. And it follows a character, quote unquote, Jamie H, through a sort of usual day of going into campus, teaching, meeting with professors, meeting with students, et cetera, all as the day leads up to a party that she and her roommate are throwing. And there is a strange sort of paranormal thing happening, which is that there's like this thing that, like a kind of cloud that follows her. And she refers to it as the specter. And it appears and it does things throughout the chapter that I think lead into a revelation at the end, but at the end of the chapter. However, so I have my personal sense of what I was trying to do with that. You know, like in the period of time that I'm referencing there, like I wasn't personally seeing hallucinations of ghosts or something.
Yeah.
Right. Like that is part of the autofictional enterprise. Like I'm allowed to invent.
Mm-hmm.
Like the chapter is like from life, but it's not strictly factual.
That's what makes the book so cool, is that you're reinventing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, like the thing about it is, it's so funny that when like someone slaps the subtitle a memoir on a book, suddenly it's as if it has to be like this totally objective historical document. And like any memoir that you produce is going to be subjective. It is going to be artistic. It is going to be labored at, and it's going to rely on recollected memories and feelings. And mm-hmm. those things are not always, you know, just the facts. I think that there is a sort of atmosphere that also comes into play when you're writing something from life. But yeah, so like, I think that I tried to leave the specter open to a lot of interpretive possibilities. And I think that there are several ways that I could see it being read that, and that feels exciting to me. Like I like the idea that there are different ways of reading the book and it's not just, this is what happened and I'm either taking it or I'm not, you know? Like I like that that feels like a moment of like very like creative. It feels like a thrillingly creative moment for me.
Yeah, because in the first part when as I'm reading it, I'm like, I'm not sure what's about to happen mm-hmm. next. And it's like this, you're anticipating something terrible happening and then mm-hmm. it doesn't happen. It's like something around the corner and it's really like a horror movie, but then Yeah,
I mean, that's sort of, I think that horror as a genre is very foundational for my world view and like how I, not only because like, you know, horrible things happen to me or something like that, but the horror genre, particularly like horror movies. And like I said, I read so much Stephen King when I was a teenager, but like horror movies are so integral to like my artistic sort of, what is the word I'm looking for? Like my artistic canon. And it was really fun actually. You know, part of the book process, like the writing process of the book, I had to figure out ways to have fun. It was so mm-hmm. dark, you know, it was so difficult. It was so re-traumatizing. So there had to be things for me to animate myself. And one of the ways I did that was kind of playing with like horror movie tropes and references in the first two chapters, which felt like very oriented around that. Like the second chapter I think of is sort of my true crime chapter. And yeah, the first chapter is like both an homage to Virginia Woolf and Mrs. Dalloway and like the academic novel. And it's also, yeah, I think kind of a ghost story.
Mm-hmm. And you're kind of, I asked you this in like the email, if you were like paying homage to your undergraduate thesis where you wrote about fairy tales and feminist theory.
I would say it's part of the texture there. But you know, I haven't looked at that in my God, like 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like 20 years. So, maybe a little less, sorry. I'm like mixing my dates up. I am not that old. But like close enough. And so I think I have like a hardbound copy around here somewhere actually, but I haven't looked at it in 1 million years. And so like what I wrote about there, I'm not entirely, you know, it's not at the top of my mind. I think that I always kind of turn to fairy tales, though. Like, they also feel like deep foundation texts, like Greek myths, and also like the Brothers Grimm were so important to me, and Hans Christian Andersen. Also, a lot of, like, you know, the three women I wrote on in the thesis were Anne Sexton, Margaret Atwood, and Angela Carter. And those remain very important figures for me. I had a mentor in college, Nancy Gray, who is brilliant and who I reconnected with a couple years ago. But she taught this great class called Feminist Fairy Tales or Feminist Revisions of Fairy Tales, something like that. It had like another title. It was like Breaking the Spell or The Wizard Behind the Curtain or something. Anyway, but she like introduced me and like so many students to an entire other world of like these radical revisions by women, especially, I mean, it's funny because I've written on a number of other women who did very similar things in my criticism, like Rachel Ingalls, I wrote on a couple years ago. And just this like past week, I finished writing something about Elaine Craft, who I also think is like doing feminist fairy tale revisions. And like the 70s feel like such a fertile time for that. Like the women's lib moment feels like such a fertile time for women to turn to these master narratives of femininity and sexuality and marriage and motherhood, and to say like, we're actually going to upend all of this and try and look at ways of telling these kinds of stories where our desire is present, where ambivalence happens, where marriage and motherhood may not be the only thing. Maybe you just want to fuck the beast, you know, mm-hmm. like, so I don't know if it was like a direct homage. I mean, there's the detail about Sleeping Beauty in there and how I watched it when I was a kid. And that is very true. I actually did watch that movie 1 million times as a fucking kid. I loved Sleeping Beauty. And I think it comes up in my first book too. I think I write about that as well. Or at least I write about this movie. God, I just reread the book earlier this week because I recorded the audiobook, but it's called Sleeping Beauties, maybe. I forget the director. And I think it's kind of a loose adaptation of the Yasunari Kawabata book, The House of the Sleeping Beauties. It's very strange. I don't know. I think a lot of people have like kind of revised that narrative with an eye to the way it's really kind of a rape story.
I found this, the book kind of begins, like part one begins with this. There's a recurring image of like an oven. Can you talk about your fascination with the Sylvia Plath?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like, you know, sometimes that's exactly what I was getting at with the Spectre, where it's like, I love your interpretation of the Spectre. And, you know, I have my own interpretations, but it's like so fun to hear someone else make these connections. And like, for me, the oven, I mean, of course it's a Plath thing, but I hadn't really like consciously been like, I am going to have an oven at the center of this chapter. It was more just like, what would she be doing in the kitchen, you know, in the morning? And I was picturing the kitchen that I had in the apartment I was living in and thinking about like what I would do when I was like rushing to get to the commuter rail in the morning. And what also I wouldn't do, which is like, I wouldn't really cook with the oven in the morning since I didn't have time. So it would be very like disorienting to come to and see like the oven was on, like who the fuck did this? My fascination with Plath. Yeah. I mean, like she was so important to me. She remains incredibly important to me. When I was in high school, I read The Bell Jar, which was like, it just kind of like broke my world open. I thought it was so strange and so sharp and funny. Like, I think people really don't give Plath credit for being a comic, like a comedian. Like, she's so fucking funny. The Bell Jar is insanely funny. I actually just listened to an audiobook of it over the summer that Maggie Gyllenhaal narrates, and Maggie Gyllenhaal just like gets it. Like she truly like captures that wry Plathian voice in a way that feels so brilliant. But, you know, her poems, I also read the Ariel poems in high school, and I didn't know poetry could do the things that she was doing. You know, like I think most of the poetry I was familiar with was either very ancient, like Odyssey, Iliad sort of stuff, Or it was very standard, like high school text poetry, you know? And there were things that I loved, you know, like I loved Keats. I still love Keats. I love a lot of the romantics. I love Eliot. And I feel like maybe we read a little, we probably read Prufrock in high school. And maybe a little Elizabeth Bishop, who I also love. But Plath wrote poems that felt so kind of chatty, like without being simple. Like they were still very challenging, but there's like a conversational quality to the Ariel poems, like very confrontational tone. And like the nursery rhyme of Daddy is like was so strange to me. I was like, how is this? How does this sound like something you would read to a child? And yet it's doing the most bizarre things with the interpersonal relationships between men and women, but also with like historical traumas. And so like Plath was the first poet that made me think like, I actually want to write poetry. Like I could write poetry, maybe not to say I was like, I could be as good as Plath or something like that. Rather, it was just like, oh, like if this can be poetry, then I think that some of the stuff that I work on in my diary or whatever, like might be able to be shaped into poetry. And so, yeah, she was just like, she kind of revolutionized my worldview about like what a woman's voice might be like. And there was also so much about like rage, you know, like being, having access to rage. Not that that's the only thing that I like in Plath or the only thing that she does. I think that her work is so much more emotionally expansive than people allow. But I think, you know, at the time I really had all of this anger that I didn't know how to give voice to. And someone like, yeah, like someone like Plath and the Ariel poems, like listening to Tori Amos's Voice for Pele or listening to PJ Harvey, listening to Hole, like suddenly there were all these women who were like, I'm going to fucking burn everything down. And I needed to feel like I could burn everything down.
Yeah. There was a part of my life where I was going to do drag for like a class, and like Hole was, I was trying to find a song like no one was listening to at the time. And I picked out the one of the songs from Hole, and like, yeah, it's cool that you brought that up. The switch from part one to part two, I was not expecting, and I loved it because it's such a change, because you go from the memoir thing to like true crime. And that's almost like a representation of like the times of like the 2010s, because everyone kind of got into true crime. Was that like a thing you were specifically trying to do?
I think, you know, that's a good question. Because I actually really, I'm so averse to true crime, honestly. I'm trying to think of one that I read the one, what is it? I'll Get Lost in the Dark, that one about the Golden State Killer.
I've read that too, yeah.
I didn't remember when it came out, but I definitely read that. I think it's much later than that, yeah. Like maybe it was because I don't remember when she died. She died very suddenly. I want to say like, you know, I'm not going to guess. But I think it came out a little later. Yeah. I did read that. And there was one podcast that I remember I listened to sometimes. It's that big one with the two women.
My Favorite Murder.
Yes, I listened to that on occasion. But I think ultimately I ended up finding true crime kind of not even like distasteful or unethical. It just
wasn't your thing.
Yeah, it just wasn't. It didn't fit the way that I wanted to think through ecosystems of violence, you know. And I think some people do it better than others. I think that the cult-like fascination that has kind of overtaken the genre feels very strange to me, and maybe like very damaging in a lot of ways. But for me, like with the second chapter and the way that I oriented around kind of like what I'm calling it, you know, I called it earlier my true crime chapter, is more thinking, like less thinking like pop cultural true crime and more thinking about like women who have written on like some of my favorite women who have done like trial reporting. So like, I think about like Helen Garner, the Australian writer who like that became such a touchstone for the latter half of her career. I'm thinking about Janet Malcolm. I'm thinking, you know, Janet Malcolm's book on Plath actually was like very urgent to me. and it wasn't about a trial, but it was about the sort of kind of like the thorny legal and the shit that got involved in the Plath Hughes estate stuff, as in addition to other things. But so thinking about Janet Malcolm, thinking about Joan Didion, you know, and like the way that she did reporting, or like sort of like went into scenes and acted as this like strange eye, and like wrote about these like scenarios from a very like present first person place. And so those were sort of the writers I was thinking about. But as I say in the chapter, my time in Boston felt so bookended by these two horrible rupture events, one of which was a triple murder in the town where my school was, which is just outside of Boston. Three men were basically decapitated, and all this weed and all this cash was dumped on the bodies. It happened on September 11th, 2011. And I mean, it's a crime that remains unsolved. But when the Boston Marathon bombing happened, basically what came about was like, they sort of tied one of the Tsarnaev brothers to the Waltham murders 3 years before, or 2 years before. And so like those two events felt so emblematic in some way to me. They felt like two of the memories that I had the clearest sense of. I think that so much of the time I was in grad school, I was like deeply dissociated, or like drugging myself into oblivion, like on weekends. And so like, just thinking about those murders and then the bombing, I was like, well, why am I latching onto these things so deeply? Like, obviously, you know, now I don't think people even remember the marathon bombing. Like, I'll bring that up and people are like, oh, I guess I kind of remember that. I'm like, 300 people were injured, like several, like three people were killed. I don't know, it just felt like such an immense event at the time. And also just like the way that Boston sort of assimilated this knowledge, particularly around the Tsarnaev brothers and like discourses around like terrorism and things like that, like the war on terror kind of resurfaced. So yeah, like I guess I was sort of thinking like, well, is part of the reason why I'm so fascinated by these events because I was much in the way that like chapter one, I'm refusing to look at what had happened. And I'm using all of these things to distract myself from what had happened. With the second chapter, I think that there's something to be said about the way that maybe I was sort of like looking at these events and fixating on them as a way to avoid looking back on myself.
Oh, for real? I didn't even think of that. So when you were writing it, were you kind of reluctant? Because like this was, true crime wasn't a thing that you were into. When you're writing it, you're finding a new process, I would think, of in writing. And like you're having to like mix that in with you, as you just talked about, you're kind of focusing on these things as a way to not write, but then it's like helping it, it's you're progressing the writing of the thing that you write about.
I think that it was another place where it was nice to have something besides rape to write about.
Yeah.
It was nice to have these other horrible violences to
write. But you're also finding a way to like write, you know, like a journalist. You're, because their style of the writing completely changes.
Yeah.
Because it's a new form or it's a new thing.
I mean, I think the whole book for me is so much about distance and proximity. I keep bringing this up in interviews, like, but it's true. Like, I think that part of the way that the four chapters create a rhythm is like, how far away am I from the event in this chapter? How close am I willing to get to these things that happened? Like, how close am I getting? And I think I play with different positionalities in each of the chapters. And so...
that makes sense.
Yeah, there are things that you do in writing that you don't realize you're doing at the time. You know, like talking about the book, I turned it in last April. You know, it's been almost a year since I finished it. And so, like, there are things that have sort of coalesced in different fashions than I expected them to. Now, when I'm talking about the book to other people, they bring up things like you did, bring up things that I hadn't thought about before. And then I think, oh yes, that makes sense. Like, now I have another way of thinking about what I was doing here. But, you know, like, the book is more of an object now than it was when I was in the thick of it. When I was in the thick of it, I was just in the thick of it. And it was, you know, writing requires you in a way, and I think I say this in the book, writing kind of requires you to slightly dissociate, like you have to go elsewhere to write. And so now it feels like I'm both more present and further apart from it because my book has become an art object and it's something that other people are engaging with. And it doesn't any longer feel to be like this thing that I own or like this, like the story is still mine, but it's also kind of like part of a broader world now. And being able to see that when I look back on it, I can kind of see the way that I was telling a story and it's becoming sort of embedded in other literary or political contexts.
If this book was made into like a television series and each chapter was a season, would you change the way the show was directed or shot?
It's funny you ask that because a few people have asked me about like adaptation, and I would be so shocked if anyone wanted to adapt the book. I think it's a little, it's so fragmentary. It's so like formally sort of restless. I have repeatedly said that the only way I could see it really working is if someone really weird wanted to do it and kind of wanted to do a non-straight adaptation. Like they wanted to just sort of like do something really like spectral and meditative, you know, and very experimental in its own right. Like, I think if someone wanted to do a film where the bones of the story were there, but like they wanted to do a totally different formal experiment, I could see it happening. I guess like if I'm being asked whether it were to be turned into a four season series, if I would want each one to have a different register, like a different formal register, I think that's a great idea. I think that's really cool. Like, of course I want to imagine that, but yeah, I don't know. Like a lot of writers in this moment, I have such ambivalence around the idea of anyone in a film studio touching anything, not even because I'm like, this is mine and I'm being proprietary around it. More because like so many people, you know, they get optioned or they write scripts for an Amazon series or they do this, that, and the other, and they tie up their writing lives with Hollywood. And then it just all falls apart because the money disappears or the director disappears or whatever. And so like the idea of like having to be involved in something that probably would never get off the ground feels very like a waste of my time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I think, yeah, it would be in a utopia where the book got adapted, I would want it to be really weird. Yeah.
Would you let like one of the episodes be like stop motion?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, something like that would be super cool. I actually did a stop motion like movie when I was in middle school. I did like one of those camps, that like art camp things, just like it was nearby. Like, my mom drove me there like every Saturday morning or whatever, and we made like a little stop motion film. Yeah, I mean, I'm even thinking of like, did you see the last season of Fargo?
I might have.
The one with John Hamm?
No, I did not see that.
It's great. And this season is very much about domestic violence. And there's an episode that is told with like wooden puppets.
Oh.
And it's really fucking cool and so bizarre. And it makes so much sense in how it happens. But it also feels like so disorienting when it starts. And then by the end of the episode, you're like, oh, of course, like this is the best possible decision someone could make in telling this story. So yeah, things like that would be so great.
Why did you centralize the book around plots?
What do you mean?
Well, it's called Trauma Plot. And I feel like each part of the book is around a different plot device, maybe? Does that make sense? Is that true or no? I just came up with that in my head.
I think that each part sort of orients around a different form or a different perspective. You know, like I change perspectives with each of them.
When I was reading the intro, I thought the idea of the plot, you were using it to experiment around, to transform the idea of what a trauma piece is supposed to be about. You want to play around with it and do different things so it's not when people are coming in to read it, they're not expecting one thing because you completely changed the entire form and idea.
Yeah, I mean, I just
Because like in the first part, I when I'm reading it, I'm wanting it to go a different way, but I know that this thing is going to happen at the end of the chapter, and that very it I related that to like a movie where I'm watching some action movie. I really like the characters, I like the scenes, but I know this like stupid plot's going to come in and kind of ruin everything, and we have to go this one way. It almost felt like part one kind of felt like that because I know this bad thing is going to happen. I don't want it to happen. I want the characters to just keep living their lives, you know? Like I wish the book wasn't about what it was about. I wish it had gone different ways.
You and me both, buddy. Yeah, you know, like I really hope the next book I write is happy, but yeah, I mean, I don't know if I went into this being like when I first started writing the book, it was 10 years ago, and I don't know that I necessarily went into it even realizing I was going to write a book at all. But I certainly didn't go into it once I started writing with like a specific, I'm going to stick it to the man, like idea, where I was like, I'm not going to tell a conventional rape memoir story. It was just like, I kind of started writing and then I kept writing and then I was writing a ton more. And I didn't feel like I had a sense of what shape the book needed to take once I realized it was a book. And you don't, you know, there are lots of things that you write and write and write, and they don't end up cohering into a book. And I thought maybe this is one of them because I just worked on it for so long and there was just so much material. You know, I cut like 30,000 words out of this manuscript, like when I,
Whoa.
and so it was actually also like a lot longer. Yeah, they were like, we'll have to like kill you if you turn a manuscript in that long. No, they didn't actually say that, but they were like, production cost goes up so much, like we need to slim this down. Yeah, so I think it was that it wasn't like so much like I'm going to be unconventional, I'm going to be experimental. And it was more that I kept trying to do something that felt more straightforward. Like I tried to do it as a poetry book for a really long time. And I had like 100 pages of poetry. And it just didn't feel encompassing. Like it didn't do what I needed it to do. It felt so circumscribed. And then I thought, well, maybe it's a first person memoir. Maybe it's kind of like some of the essays I've written, like fucking like a housewife. You know, I was like, maybe it's like that. And it's sort of like a hybrid first person memoir that is in fragments. You know, maybe it's like a Maggie Nelson book or a Sarah Manguzzo book. And I tried to do that, and it also didn't feel like it was holding, it didn't feel like the right edifice for the story. And I kept trying different costumes on, basically. And eventually I was like, oh, I actually think that this needs to be a lot of different things, like not merely hybrid, but like polyvocal in some way. Like it has to have multiple voices. It has to have different, like it has to imagine rape in different genres because, you know, my experience of sexual violence felt very fragmentary. It felt very unmooring. It also didn't feel like my narrative of violence was particularly usual or recognizable. Like it wasn't like I was just like living my usual life and I was a really good girl. And eventually my super normal life was interrupted by this horrific event and it was really bad and then I got over it, you know, because that's kind of the typical trauma plot in a way. Or it's like the trauma plot that people want. They want you to be a really good person who they can sympathize with, and then they want something horrible to happen to you. And then they want you to convince them that actually you just heal and it all gets better and you're cured. And that's not what happened. I hope plenty of people feel cured and healed, but it wasn't what happened for me. And there was a recursivity to the violence that felt very unignorable. Like it was sort of impossible to tell a linear story when rape kept happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you know, I've said this in other interviews, I say this in the book, like, I am not precluded from getting raped again, you know, which is like maybe a horrible, shitty, dark thing to say. But like, the story of my life is only gonna be over when I'm dead, you know? And even then, like, whoever you were kind of outlives you. So I just like, I didn't, like a more usual plot just didn't seem like the container. And I guess that was ultimately why I ended up doing other things with it.
You work as a bartender. Would you like to see like some sort of program thing where you didn't have to work so hard and you could focus more time on writing?
Yeah, I mean, I wish that we had, I wish that a living wage was a living wage. You know, like I wish that we were not at the behest of billionaires. I wish that there was space in creative life for working class artists. I think of myself, I have a very working class background. I think of myself as a working writer, you know, like I don't have a staff job. I'm not a contributing person anywhere. And in some ways that's very freeing. Like I don't have to take assignments I don't want to fucking take, which is great. When I was bartending more, I didn't have time to write. And I feel very fortunate that this sounds sort of crass, but like when the pandemic happened and I lost all my jobs, that was when I wrote the first book. And basically between the viral essay that came out that year, Fucking Like a Housewife, and the book, it's not like I suddenly was making a ton of money on writing, but it did open up doors for me to make more money with writing. And so writing became a supplemental income for me, which meant ultimately that like over the last couple of years, I've been able to scale back my bartending, and I only bartend two nights a week now. And I can't imagine a world in which I was bartending more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And writing as much as I do. But yeah, I mean, the state of the arts right now is just really dire, and it's demoralizing and devastating. And I think like wealth inequality is like, you know, one of the central issues of our time. There, obviously we have so many things to worry about, but just thinking about the way that haves and have nots operates in like American life right now is like shocking. It shocks me. It shocks me watching like what's happening. I don't know, in the news, like it's, every day I think I can't be shocked, and I'm shocked more. So of course, like I wish, God, what is that program that FDR did? The WPA? Anyway, yeah, like of course I wish there was like essentially a socialist program like provided by the, I don't know, I guess maybe there's damage to be done with the federal government, you know, funding the arts as well, but like, I do wish that there was like a universal basic income, sure. Like, so that more people could have access to making art. Like, we should be able to do that. That's what life on this earth should be about. Like, it shouldn't be about fucking, like, losing all of your days to shitty jobs, mm-hmm. You know? Like, I don't know. It makes me, sorry, I'm like getting a little upset because I'm like, it makes me sad how difficult it is to be an artist and to not have significant sources of funding. Like, it's so hard for people, and it's been so hard for me. And like, I feel incredibly fortunate that I'm at a place where I'm able to balance a little more my sort of, you know, manual labor with my artistic labor.